From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with singer-songwriter and guitarist Loudon Wainwright. He writes humorous songs and social satires. Also today, I'll speak with Mary Peacock, the style editor for The Village Voice. She brought fashion into the alternative press. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the London Symphony Orchestra's new recording of Schoenberg piano and violin concertos. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg wonders what happened to the language invented by the hippie counterculture. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is singer-songwriter and guitarist Loudon Wainwright III. He's best known for the novelty hits Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road and I Want to Be on MTV, but most of his songs are too idiosyncratic for the pop charts. He writes social satires, as well as humorous, sometimes depressive songs about his own life. Rock critic Ken Tucker said of Wainwright, "No pop songwriter has written about marriage and parenthood with more honesty, with more pain, joy, and frustration." Such songs can be heard on Wainwright's new album, More Love Songs, just released on the Rounder record label. Over the last 12 years or so, Wainwright has returned to one of his earlier passions, acting. He appeared in several episodes of MASH, an off-Broadway production of Harold Pinter's The Birthday Party, the musical Pump Boys and Dinettes, and he also had a supporting role in the film adaptation of the Neil Simon comedy, The Slugger's Wife. Loudon Wainwright III is the son of Life magazine writer Loudon Wainwright. Loudon Wainwright is currently based in London. He's now touring the States, and he's brought his guitar and is going to play a few songs for us. Loudon, welcome to Fresh Air. And before we talk, can I ask you to open with a song?
Sure, sure.
Why don't you do one from your new record?
Okay, this is called Unhappy Anniversary.
Unhappy anniversary, it's 1 year since we split. I walk and talk and get around, lie down, stand up and sit. I eat and drink and smoke and sleep and live a little bit. Unhappy anniversary, it's 1 year since we split. Unhappy anniversary, it's 10 years since we met. There is no need to remind me, no way I could forget. Fell in love, then we fell out. Both times there was no net. Unhappy anniversary, it's 10 years since we met. Unhappy anniversary, I cannot count the days and nights that I have thought of you since we went separate ways. I tell my mind to forget you, but my heart disobeys. Unhappy anniversary, I cannot count the days. Unhappy anniversary, it's 1 year since we split. I walk and talk and get around, lie down, stand up and sit. I eat and drink and smoke and sleep and live a little bit. Unhappy anniversary, it's 1 year since we split.
That sounds great. That's Loudon Wainwright performing live in our studios. You know, your new album is almost like a concept album of someone who's turning middle-aged, who's recently divorced, is a father, kind of depressed about the whole thing. Do you see it that way?
Is it that bad? Did it come across that bad?
No, I mean, there's some very humorous stuff on it, too, but it does seem as a kind of concept album about where you are now in your own life.
Well, it's called More Love Songs, and it does, a lot of the songs are kind of deal with a particular relationship and the breaking up and what follows, and I think it's quite a dark record. I agree with you, and it should be listened to with caution.
You write very personal songs, and there are periods in pop music where most songs seem to be about relationships, mostly about falling in love.
Yeah,
and I think you've been able to take songwriting into other areas, which is very difficult to do.
Mm. Yeah, well, I've written a lot of love songs. I mean, I had another album of love songs that was called Unrequited, and I think that's a lot of the love songs that I do write have to do with kind of the darker aspects of it. But I don't know really what the heck I'm doing.
You have a song on your new album called The Back Nine that's
right.
Kind of golf as a metaphor, the back nine being an almost metaphor for the second part of life and fumbling your way through it. And I was wondering if you were depressed about getting older.
Well, I'll tell you. No, I feel great about getting older.
Okay.
I have to write about what you know about. And unlike everyone else, I'm focused, particularly since I just had my 40th birthday.
Right.
I'm focused on the back nine of my life, I suppose, and I write about it. I mean, these songs, people do call them depressing or something, but you got to remember that they're exaggerations of things to a certain extent. They're rooted in real things, but I'm not the suicidal, depressive guy that I sometimes seem in these songs.
I think it was when you were 30, you wrote "Watch Me Rock, I'm Over 30," and that kind of raised questions of, well, you can still play. You can still sing and play rock and roll when you're over 30. You must feel like you were very young when you were thinking you were getting older.
Yeah, well, I'm very focused on myself. I'm a very selfish person. These songs come out of my dinky little life. I mean, but it's all I have to work with.
You know what I'm thinking? Like, so many of us are preoccupied with what happens to rock and roll when the people get older. And I think part of the reason for that preoccupation is that initially, rock and roll is for teenagers, and all the adults liked a different kind of pop. And it was assumed that when the teenagers became adults, they'd have to like what their parents used to like.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have problems with what does a rock and roller do when they get older? Is that a big question?
I don't have any problems with that. I mean, I like music if it's good, and you know, there's a lot of great older people out there playing, swinging older people, you know.
You're living in London now, and do you think of yourself as an expatriate? Have you left for good?
No, I don't think so. I think I just wanted to get out of the United States for a while for some personal and professional reasons and just spend some time over there. I've enjoyed being over there. I've worked on my last two albums with Richard Thompson and another friend of mine who's based over there, a guy named Haim Tannenbaum. And I have a pretty good following over there, and they speak English, so hey, it's my kind of place.
I want to ask you to play another song.
Yeah, I'll play another song from this record of mine, or that's on this record of mine. Let me just tune a little bit.
While you're tuning, I'll reintroduce you. My guest is Loudon Wainwright, and he's performing live for us, and the song he's going to play is also featured on his new album, which is called More Love Songs.
Your mother and I are living apart. I know that seems stupid, but we weren't very smart. You'll stay with her, I'll visit you. At Christmas, on weekends, in the summertime too. Your mother and I are not getting along. Somehow, somewhere, something went wrong. Everything changes, time takes its toll. Your folks fell in love, love's a very deep hole. Your mother and I will do all we can do to work this thing out and to take care of you. Families get broken, I know it's a shame. It's nobody's fault though, and you're not to blame. Your
Your mother and I are both feeling bad, but things will get better, they won't stay this sad. And I hope when you grow up, one day you'll see your parents are people, and that's all we can be. Your mother and I.
It's a really moving song. Did you do you know if your ex-wife and your child have ever heard the song yet?
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, they hear. They're some of my biggest fans.
Oh good. My guest is Loudon Wainwright, who's playing for us live. Let me ask you about your past. Let's talk about your life a little bit. Your father is Loudon Wainwright, the Life magazine writer, who's
right.
a very well-known journalist. Did you start writing when you were pretty young?
Not really. My intention in life was to be an actor. I knew I wanted to be in show business, and I thought I was going to be an actor. In fact, I went to and studied acting at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, which at that time was the late 60s, was a very, very good drama school. I think it still is. And but I dropped out of acting school in the late 60s and kind of became an itinerant hipster, you know, went out to San Francisco and did that whole thing and hitchhiked around and then fell into playing the guitar and writing songs. I had never thought I'd make a living doing that. And then, as you mentioned, I kind of returned to acting with the MASH things and whatchamacallit, but I'm still primarily earning my living as a musician.
The way you say you fell into writing songs, it sounds like you had no idea you could either write, sing, or play.
Well, I knew I could sing and play. I had learned how to play the guitar in boarding school when I was a younger teenager and had little folk bands and stuff like that. I didn't think I could write. I was living in a staying with a friend in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he had a guitar there. So I remembered my five chords, which are the five chords that I still use, by the way. And I picked up the guitar and wrote this terrible song about a lobster fisherman that I knew in Rhode Island. But it was enough to get me interested in the idea that all of a sudden, wow, I can write a song.
Oh, the temptation is for me to embarrass you and ask you to play the first verse of it.
Luckily, I've forgotten that entire song. And but it was enough. I had written a song, and this was a great, exciting thing. And then I just started to write five and six songs a week. I became obsessed.
You said you wanted to be in show business, and I wonder if you think of what you're doing now as show business. Show business also implies your suits and cufflinks and a much more
Vegas-y type thing.
Thank you. Vegas-y, yes.
Well, I think it is show business. I mean, it's the business and the job of doing a show. And as I said before, a lot of these songs may paint a picture of me as, well, at least the two that I've played this afternoon, you might think that I'm suicidal or something. But the whole thing is
and in fact, you have written songs about suicide.
Yeah, I have. I mean, I present a character, actually, is what I do. And I probably shouldn't be divulging this. But yeah, that's what I do. That's what everybody does. I mean, it's all show business. Jim and Tammy is show business. Mr. President is show business. I mean, I think it is a bit, you know, as long as people are observing it and sitting down or paying for it, it's show business, no matter what it is.
When you started playing, you were playing at some of the coffee houses in Greenwich Village and playing small clubs. It was a period, I suppose this was during the late 60s or so.
That's when I started, yeah.
There was a period when a lot of bohemianism was about severing all ties to the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And you came from an obviously middle class background, but your father was well known enough that it would have been hard to act as if you were from this mysterious background, which
Delta,
is what a lot of people
right.
were doing. Even Bob Dylan did that. He changed his background completely. Did that stand in your way, or did you ever wish you could come from a less explicit
No,
past?
In fact, I utilized that. I mean, I came from the from Westchester County, New York, which is a very affluent suburb of New York City. And I wore Brooks Brothers shirts and wingtip flyers and, you know, gray flannel pants. And did then and still do write songs about golf courses. I mean, I've drawn on my background of being a white middle class guy from the suburbs. I mean, I've used it, and because that's what I know, that's what I am,
and that's what you're going to write about.
Yeah.
My guest is Loudon Wainwright, and he has his guitar with him. He's going to perform a couple of more songs a little later in the program. He also has a new album called More Love Songs. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is singer-songwriter and guitarist Loudon Wainwright. And Loudon, can I ask you to do another song for
us? Sure. Let me just... Yeah, this song is called I Eat Out. I'm on a tour now, and I'm spending a lot of time eating in restaurants by myself.
I can cook a little, but it's not a lot to shout about. It's kind of mean cuisine, so I eat out. Hey, they know me at the Greek and the Chink and the Itai and the Indian too. And they all say, here comes that sad American man again, what are we gonna do? Well, you can put me in the corner, in the table, in the back, unless you got one in a telephone booth. I'm here and I'm alone again, it's sad, but it's the truth. No, I'm not expecting anyone. Is that beyond belief? Give me the menu, take away the candle, never mind the aperitif. They got a couple of couples, a trio and a foursome. They even got a party of eight. I'm getting that look. I wish I'd brought a book. Or better yet, I wish I'd already ate. What's the matter with you people? You're telling jokes and you're holding hands and you're talking with your mouths full. Well, the waiter comes up and he asks me, how is it, sir? Is everything all right? The food's fine, but I feel like a fool because I'm eating alone tonight. Don't say I was here at all. What would all my loved ones think? I'll take a check, no sweet, no coffee, no after dinner drink. I can cook a little, but it's not a lot to shout about. Oh, it's kind of mean cuisine, so I eat out.
Great song. It's a wonderful song. This song really reminds me of all the efforts I've gone through eating alone, trying to prop up a book against ketchup bottles so I can read and act invisible.
It's a very embarrassing thing, eating alone.
It is, it is. And people have a way of making you feel embarrassed, too, sometimes.
Yeah.
Let's talk some more about your life now. Your big hit in the early 70s was Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road.
Yeah.
And I'd like to ask you how you wrote the song.
Well, I ran over a skunk that had already been run over, I guess, a few times. And for some reason, went home and in a matter of 12 minutes, wrote this song, which is will probably be my on my epitaph or something. I don't know. It was just one of those things. Quite often, the songs come very quickly, and I just wrote this silly little nonsensical song, and just in under 20 minutes, couldn't have been more than 20 minutes. And then I started to sing it in clubs and stuff, and people reacted very strongly. So I knew that maybe there was something to it all. But it's strange. I mean, I'm kind of, if I had to have a single, I'm kind of proud of the fact that it's a song called Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road, I think, in a way. And it was fun to do it, although the problem is that I was quite young when it happened. And, you know, the record company wanted to know, when I delivered my next album, where the Funny Animal song was, you know, they, in their minds, that's basically what I was going to be, which was a total novelty songwriter.
So that can be, a hit can be like a noose around your neck.
Yeah, it can, you know.
A little overdramatic there, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it creates difficulties, particularly if you're not ready. And I don't think I was ready, but I'm ready now.
That's right.
Can I have my hit now? I'm ready.
Do people still force you to sing it when you play clubs?
Nobody forces me to do anything. I do still sing it, though, because I went through a period where I refused to sing it. I became very rebellious about the whole thing because it only went to number 12 nationally, but in some parts of the country, for instance, in Little Rock, Arkansas, it was number one for 6 weeks in a row. So I really developed a kind of a perverse attitude about the whole thing. But now, in an emergency, I'll certainly play it, you know, if things aren't going too well in a show. And sometimes I'm in the mood to play it. It's a good audience sing-along song.
Should I or should I not ask you to do a chorus of it?
In case people don't remember it?
Yeah.
Well, there has to be a reason, doesn't there? You want the chorus or a verse?
A verse. And my guess is Loudon Wainwright.
You see, my body's rebelling and my guitar's out of tune. Here it goes.
Crossing the highway late last night. You should've looked left and you should've looked right. Didn't see the station wagon car. The skunk got squashed and there you are. You got a dead skunk.
Everybody out there in Radio Land has got to sing in on this one.
You got a dead skunk in the middle of the road. Dead skunk in the middle of the road. Dead skunk in the middle of the road. Stanking the high heaven.
You want more?
That's fine. Because I want to save some time for a new song at the end.
Okay.
But thanks for doing that. It's actually a very enjoyable song.
No, it's not a bad song. In fact, it's very cathartic for me to do it.
Good. I'm glad I gave you that opportunity. Mm. Was it a big decision to you when that was a hit, whether you were going to try to deliver the next Animal Novelty song or just keep going your own way?
One more time, ask me that again.
Did you have to make a decision whether you were going to try to keep delivering novelty hits?
Well, I was in conflict for a number of years. I certainly didn't try to make another hit Animal song, but I certainly felt under pressure to come up with a hit single. And I think that was a mistake on my part, probably. Rather than just writing the songs and trying to make the best records possible. That's one of the problems when you're in the big commercial world out there, you know, you're expected to duplicate your successes and take whatever you do and make it palatable for everybody.
You're really a very, I think, idiosyncratic songwriter and performer.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean that as a compliment. And I think we're living in a world that's getting more and more homogenized where it's more and more difficult to go your own way. Are there enough like clubs and colleges left where you can perform now that the quote folk revival and the folk rock scene aren't what they used to be?
Yeah. Well, in England, interestingly enough, they're saying there's a resurgence of that, although I've heard that before. When I travel by myself, there are plenty of places I can play and it all becomes economically feasible. At the moment, in some of the places I'm going, I'm taking two other fellows with me. And so you have the economics of three hotel rooms and plane tickets and stuff. And then it becomes hard. But as a solo guy, it's not tough, really. And I'm lucky because there are a lot of places that I can play. I also play a lot in Europe, and I'm going to Japan in July for the second time, and Australia. And so there's work out there for me.
Great. I'd like to ask you to play a new song, if you would, one that you haven't recorded yet. Would that be okay?
Sure. Got a tune again.
Okay. Guess I keep asking for songs.
The
with
great
the wrong
thing about my album
it.
Is that there's absolutely no tuning on it. We cut all that out.
Loudon Wainwright is my guest, and he has a new album which is called More Love Songs. He's performing for us live today.
This is called Mind Read.
I knew I forgot something, I guess I always do. I'm so absent-minded when it comes to you. I forgot I promised to fulfill your need. Thank you for reminding me your mind is hard to read. But it was what attracted me to you. Don't you forget I knew you had a problem. The moment that we met, you thought that I could solve it, but I doubted that was true. That thing was bigger than us both, and it belonged to you. Yeah, it belonged to you. Yeah, it belonged to you. But I'm at your disposal, that's part of our deal. I'll try not to despise you, I know what it feels like. If you have a breakdown, I can make it well. If you've got an ugly secret, well then I'm the one to tell. And there's politics involved in this, and economics too. Theatrics and aerobic exercises to go through. It's like climbing mountains and falling out of trees. It can take your breath away, but it can scab your knees, yeah. Scab your knees, yeah. Scab them knees, yeah. And they used to say that God is love, and probably they still do. But if you ask me, love is when I get along with you, and that is never easy. Sometimes it's a chore. 'Cause after everybody's had enough, you want some more. I knew I forgot something, I guess I always do. I'm so absent-minded when it comes to you. I forgot I promised to fulfill your need. Thank you for reminding me you're mine. Yeah, you're mine. It's hard to read. Yeah, it's hard to read. Hard to read.
I think that's one song I won't ask about the occasion that got you to
sure
write it.
I'm not sure what that's about, even.
A relationship that wasn't going very well, huh?
Another one of those,
all
I'm
right.
afraid.
Tell me about how you write songs. Do they come to you whole?
No. I'll get an idea. I mean, even a line, you know, or a first line, that is, which may necessarily wind up being the first one, but and then I'll just expand on it and work on it and kind of. And then there's a kind of a gestational period where I'll just think about it for a while, or a gestation period where I'll just think about it. And then they just kind of, you pull it all together. Then you take it out, or then I take it out and play it for people and see how they react and what works and what doesn't work. Then you change it some more, and then it's usually done or you forget about it.
Well, I've enjoyed your performance very much today, and I really want to thank you a lot for visiting with us on Fresh Air.
Well, thanks. I've enjoyed being here.
I've enjoyed it a lot. My guest has been Loudon Wainwright. He's a singer, songwriter, and guitarist. He's currently based in England. He's now touring the States. He also has a new album called More Love Songs. It's on the Rounder record label. This is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll talk with former New York Times reporter Raymond Bonner. In his new book, Waltzing with a Dictator, Bonner explores the United States' role in supporting the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos. So I hope you can join us.
One, a two, a one, two. The dollar went down and the president's sick. Who's in charge now? I don't know. Take your pick. A new disease every day and the old ones are coming back. Things are looking kind of gray, like they're gonna get black. Don't turn on the TV, don't show me the paper. Don't wanna know he got kidnapped or why they all raped her. I wanna go on vacation till the pressure lets up. But they keep hijacking airplanes and blowing them up. It's been a hard day on the planet. How much is it all worth? Getting harder to understand it. Things are tough all over on Earth.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the style editor of The Village Voice, Mary Peacock, talks about the pleasure and pain of shopping for clothes. Also, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of two Arnold Schoenberg concertos. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg wonders whatever happened to far out, groovy, downer, and other expressions coined by the hippie counterculture. And we'll check in with National Public Radio in Washington for the latest news. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news. This is Fresh Air. Arnold Schoenberg is often referred to as the father of atonal music. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says Schoenberg's works are often played out of a sense of duty by conductors who lack passion for his compositions, but who recognize what an important contribution he made. There's a new recording of Schoenberg's violin and piano concertos that Lloyd says reflects a deeper commitment to the work of the composer.
Schoenberg's music is hard, and his two big concertos, one for violin and the other for piano, are among his most notoriously difficult. You don't hear either of them very often in the concert hall. In a way, phonograph recordings are really the best way to get to know works of such complexity, listening to them and to passages from them over and over. Of course, one has to be interested to begin with, and this new recording by the London Symphony Orchestra on the RCA Erato label makes one want to be interested. The conductor is Pierre Boulez. His series of Schoenberg recordings on CBS Masterworks is a major landmark of 20th century music performance. The violinist is Pierre Amoyal, and the pianist Peter Serkin. These are artists whose commitment to 20th century music is profound, and whose knowledge and sensitivity are unquestionable. This is the recording to get, to study, admire, maybe even get to like, if not love, these works. The basic problem with listening to Schoenberg's atonal, serial music is that he seems to have abandoned the long singing line for a more austere, thematic formality. And it's true, the emotional landscape often sounds pretty bleak, even oppressive, or worse, so arid that it doesn't seem to have any feeling at all. That's why you need a conductor with a delicate ear to sort out the knotty threads, to put some air around the exquisite orchestral details, the passages that give a special lift to what might otherwise sound dry or lugubrious. The piano concerto, for example, is one 20-minute movement that falls into four sections. The opening andante is a theme in variations, a tone row that becomes transposed and turned upside down and backwards. But it's actually a highly autobiographical work. Schoenberg himself characterized this section as "life was easy." That was the lilting, almost childlike, yet slightly sinister opening of the Schoenberg Piano Concerto, as conducted by Pierre Boulez with Peter Serkin at the piano. This section is followed by "Suddenly Hate Broke Out, Molto Allegro," and the moving Adagio third section, "A Grave Crisis." Finally, the last, marked Giocoso, is a classical rondo in which, as Schoenberg says, life goes on. It's not exactly cheery music. How could it be, written by a German-Jewish émigré in 1942? But the way Boulez and Serkin do it, you can feel its ironic yet life-affirming bittersweetness. And the same passionate refinement is clear in the even more complex violin concerto of 1936, the piece that even Schoenberg agreed might take a six-fingered violinist to do it justice. The slow middle movement is marked andante grazioso, gracefully or graciously slow. Let's listen to the beginning of it. That was the opening of the second movement of Schoenberg's violin concerto, played with effortless ease by Pierre Amoyal under the sympathetic, affectionate, rhythmically alive direction of Pierre Boulez. We've listened to the most comforting moments of music that was never meant only to comfort. But performances like these prove that the complexity here isn't just technical, that it has a central emotional vitality that the right hands know how to bring to the surface.
Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviewed the new Erato recording of Schoenberg's Violin and Piano Concertos. Lloyd is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He's a poet and teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Peacock. She's the style editor of The Village Voice and the editor of a new book on shopping in Manhattan. She began writing about clothes and street fashion in 1970 for an underground newspaper she started called Rags. I asked her what it was like then to be writing about a subject that many in the alternative press saw as too self-indulgent and trivial to bother with.
That was actually an important time in clothes, because that's when vintage clothing was really discovered. Kids who didn't have a lot of money but wanted to wear something interesting started going to thrift stores. And that's what we were trying to get across in our magazine Rags at that time, is to say that, you know, fashion is your fashion. And if you wear beautifully patched jeans and or whatever, that's your fashion and it looks great.
You established the style section, which is called the V section, in the Village Voice. Was there any resistance initially to style being discussed every week in the Voice?
Well, actually, the editor of the paper then, David Schneiderman, who's now the publisher, was in fact was terrified that that was going to happen. So after he decided to hire me, mostly on the basis of Rags, in other words, knowing that I had a different take on fashion, it wasn't poison fashion, you know, expensive fashion. He, in fact, was so afraid that he would be criticized that he used to forget, sort of forget in quotes, to call on me in the editorial meeting every week. It took him 6 months to actually acknowledge I was there. And, of course, what happened was that no one complained. In fact, they liked it. So,
what do you think is the difference between your approach to style and the standard women's fashion magazine approach?
Well, in terms of practicality, my approach is to think about how much money the readers really do have to spend. I mean, if you look at Vogue magazine, it's full of page after page of outfits with four-figure price tags. And if you look at the demographics of the readers of Vogue, well, they're just like everyone else. They can't afford those things. And so Vogue functions in many ways as a sort of wish book, as a place where you see the newest things that are too expensive for you, but you then seeing what the styles are and you're seeing what's going to be copied later and so on. But it's not so practical usually. And so something that I'm interested in doing is showing stuff that people really can afford. And the other part of it is I'm desperate to inject a little humor in it because, after all, getting dressed is supposed to be fun. Aside from the function of keeping you warm enough or protected from the sun enough, it's really all about having fun.
Do you feel like you've created a different language to talk about style than the women's magazines have usually used?
I guess in trying to make, to translate the visual excitement of something to wear into words, that often fashion copywriters have had to resort to kind of metaphorical language like wow, zap, zing, pow kind of thing. I've been interested in having people write about clothes the way they experience them, which is usually a humor piece about, you know, how one size fits all is the fourth biggest lie, things like that.
Do you ever feel victimized by fashion because you can't possibly fit into it or because you don't look good in it?
Yeah, that's always been a problem of women being made to feel inadequate because fashion is always displayed on a sort of female ideal, whatever the fashion in females is at the moment. And that changes too, of course. I mean, in the 50s, you were supposed to have giant bazooms, and then in the 60s, you were supposed to be perfectly flat-chested. And then now, just lately, they've been saying cleavage is back. And as one of my writers said, if so, where has it been? where did it go for the last 10 years?
There are some women's fashions that are very hard to reconcile with feminism, and some of these fashions are coming back. I'm thinking of high heels, for instance, which everybody knows are really difficult to walk in, God forbid to run in. What do you think of the comeback of high heels?
High heels are only nice as an aesthetic. They look nice. It's true. And I think it's not just men who think they look nice. It's an interesting sort of shape. However, they are impossible to wear. But I think that a lot of women will wear high heels, will throw out their lower backs, will be unable to run away from trouble or jump across a puddle because the idea of them being fashionable is too strong to resist. The good news is that in the shoe store, you will also still see flats, that the manufacturers and stores no longer present just one option.
What about the comeback of short skirts?
I think that that short skirts are fun and comfortable if you want to wear them and if you feel comfortable in them. I think it's just fun if you want it. What would be a disaster is if every skirt in the store was short. As long as there's a choice, it's fine with me. There are a lot of things that I don't want to wear, but I don't mind if somebody else wants to wear them.
Do you think you judge people by their clothes?
Oh, I think everyone definitely does, and they don't even understand that they're doing it. When you look at people, you get a million tiny little clues from their appearance, which is mainly their clothes, because most of their bodies are covered with clothes and they're wearing shoes and carrying a certain purse or briefcase.
Well, I should mention that I'm talking to you from a Philadelphia studio. You're talking from the NPR studios in New York, so we can't see each other.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously our listeners can't see you either. I don't know, should we be judging you by your clothes? Should you tell us what you're wearing now?
No, you shouldn't be judging me by my clothes. But I think that if you did see me, you couldn't help it. It would be an automatic response. And when we say judge, we don't say worthy, unworthy, good or bad. It's just that you get information.
So what are you wearing, Mary?
I'm wearing a dress. This year, I suddenly got interested in dresses. It's a light blue denim shirtwaist dress, something that is not particularly fashionable. It was about 3 years ago. But it's real comfortable, and you just pop it on and put your feet in shoes, and off you go.
Why are you interested in dresses now?
I don't know. It's the feeling of it. They're cooler, really, in the summer than pants, and I think it's the natural urge for a change. I mean, that's one of the big motivating engines in fashion, is a change. And of course, we know the manufacturers want us to change so that we'll buy all new clothes. But people want change too. They wouldn't go for it if it wasn't a human desire, I don't think.
Well, your new book is about shopping. I'd like to know if you genuinely enjoy shopping.
I enjoy shopping when I have money in my pocket. To tell you the truth, I'm not a window shopper. To me, it's just torment to look at things that I couldn't possibly have. And I know this goes against the grain of what a lot of people think is the fun of shopping. But frankly, I don't think it's a museum. I think it's a store. And if I can't buy it, I don't want to look at it and be tortured.
Is it possible to cover fashion, even for the alternative press, and not become manipulated by the manufacturers who are trying to decide what they're going to get us to wear and buy?
It's very difficult not to be manipulated, even though my main message, if one could be so pretentious as to say I had a fashion message, would be that people should really learn what their own style is. They should figure out what they like and what makes them feel good, and also what, objectively speaking, looks good on them in terms of color and shape and so on. And it's extremely difficult not to be swayed away from these things that you know perfectly well are true by whatever's in fashion that season. And the most astounding thing is to experience your own eyes changing, to suddenly slowly accept shoulders, a natural shoulder growing out past Joan Crawford to the football stage and then back again, or skirts creeping up and down, or jodhpur style pants where, you know, the first thought of that is, oh my God, everyone looks like they have huge hips. Who would ever wear that? And then it's being promoted in the next season. You think, well, I see, that doesn't look so bad. And the next thing you know, you find your own hand shooting out towards a pair of these on the rack, and you think, my God, what have they done to me? I've been brainwashed.
What are some of the most stupid purchases you've ever made that really shocked you once you saw them in your own home?
Well, the thing that's, it's this idea of being invited somewhere, usually a party, where you feel a little nervous about making the right impression, and you open your closet door and there's nothing there. And you think, oh my God, I can't go in this old thing. And you rush desperately to the store. I remember literally racing up and down West Broadway in New York, trying to find something to wear, you know, as the stores were closing one after another, and I was standing begging outside the door. And I ended up spending twice as much as I should have for this white silk pantsuit that had last year's shoulders. It didn't fit anyway. I didn't really want to look like that anymore. The whole thing was a total disaster. And every time I see it, it makes me sick.
So you still have it in your closet?
I do. I'm hoping that somehow I'll find someone who will think it's just swell.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Mary Peacock, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Village Voice style editor Mary Peacock edited the new book, The Village Voice Guide to Manhattan's Hottest Shopping Neighborhoods.
Got a brand new suit, got a brand new tie, got a brand new twinkle in my eye. Do you know the reason why? Got a brand new girl, and I won't dispute. She's the reason I got a brand new tie. And
this is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you following today?
Well, the Iran-Contra hearings are in recess, but Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North is in the news. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North today informed the committees investigating the Iran-Contra dealings that he would not allow himself to be pre-interviewed, as all the other witnesses have been. It makes it harder for the committee to plan for his testimony, but North says that if they want to talk to him, they'll have to do it all in public. Also, Atlanta Mayor Andrew Young is off the hook. The U.S. attorney announced today that Young won't be charged with obstruction of justice in the investigation stemming out of accusations by Alice Bond that her estranged husband, Julian Bond, used cocaine.
Okay, thank you, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The 20th anniversary of the Sgt. Pepper's album has been an occasion for many of us to reflect on where we were in 1967 and how we've changed. Our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, was an art student in New York then. Now he lives in California. He has these thoughts on how the hippie counterculture of the 60s changed our language.
People have a special reason for waxing nostalgic about the hippie movement out here in San Francisco, where it all began. This is the 20th anniversary of the Summer of Love, when thousands of young people floated into the Haight-Ashbury district with flowers in their hair, and as often as not, with stems and seeds in their pockets. Linguistically, that time is certainly worthy of commemoration because the hippies left quite a mark on our language. Not long ago, I heard a striking example of just how commonplace some of their words have become. There was Nancy Reagan on the Joan Rivers show talking about how it had taken a lot of courage to make the national drug problem her personal concern. Apparently, some of her staff members had been opposed to her taking it on because, as she put it, oh, the drug issue was such a downer. I looked closely at the screen, but there was no sign of irony on the First Lady's face, and Joan Rivers was nodding gravely. For them, it appears, the word had been cleansed of any taint of its pharmacological origin. Now, it makes sense that downer should have been one of the words to have survived from that period. As it happens, just about all of the 60s words that are still in use have a negative meaning. Alongside of downer, for example, we still say uptight, freaked out, hang up, rip off, bummer, and drag. Whereas the positive words from the hippie lexicon have had a very different fate. Groovy, out of sight, and far out are the kind of words you would take out nowadays only at a costume party. The fortunes of the hippie movement as a whole are evident in this pattern. Most of us would be embarrassed to admit it now, but there really was a moment when it seemed as if all we needed was love. Here is a photograph from the March on the Pentagon. It shows a 17 or 18-year-old girl gently slipping a daisy into the rifle muzzle of one of the soldiers standing guard. It really was an extraordinary gesture. I confess that back then I would have said that it was far out. But of course, it was also a little simple-minded, to put it kindly. It isn't surprising that all that smarmy spirituality came to pieces in the face of the darker realities of the drug culture and the Vietnam War. Nor is it any wonder that grooviness came to be thought of as a pretty insipid concept. The hippies' enduring contribution had less to do with the turn-on and tune-in parts of their program than with the third clause, the one about dropping out. Of the three terms, note that only dropout has survived, and that it is now used only in a disparaging way. The hippies had sounded what Theodore Roszak refers to as a clear call for disaffiliation, and millions of people paid attention. By the 70s, half the young people in America had dropped out. They may not have put flowers in their hair, but they certainly weren't wearing crew cuts anymore. And they borrowed the hippies' language to express their own more cynical disaffection from middle-class American culture, with its rip-offs, its hang-ups, its uptightness. But where the hippies had been vaguely spiritual, their successors turned to narcissistic psychology to satisfy their inner needs. People had once rapped with each other, now they dialogued. They had once tried to do their own thing, now they looked for a nurturing lifestyle. 20 years after the fact, it's possible to look back on the lost language of the 60s with a certain indulgent fondness. But the language of the 70s is permanently beyond the power of nostalgia to redeem.
Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg joins us each week on Fresh Air. He's a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with singer and musician June Carter Cash. She's part of one of country music's best-known families. She grew up singing in the Carter family with her mother, Maybell Carter, and she now performs with her husband, Johnny Cash. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Bring the Family, a new album by singer-songwriter John Hiatt. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review The Believers, starring Martin Sheen, Helen Shaver, and Jimmy Smits. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.